Back at it with you on Thursday, December the 3rd on Connecticut Today. Governor Ned Lamont, in his coronavirus update for December 3rd, talked about how the initial doses of the coronavirus vaccines will be divvied out here in the state. Also, speaking of COVID-19, Chris Powell checked in from the Journal Inquirer of Manchester to talk about his latest pronunciation on that in one of his editorials. Also, I kicked off the show wondering again why progressives and those on the far left just don't get it. Before we head to the phones and give you what's up on the show today, I just, you know, some things I say, I hear, and I say. But some things I hear and I wonder exactly how dumb are people, right? And there's a lot of idiocy on both sides of the aisle. But my contention is there's more idiocy on the Democratic side of the aisle. And why do I say this? I don't know whether you were, and I'm sorry if that ticks you off, but that's just the way I see it. Our top of the hour news there from NBC Radio at the top. Former President Barack Obama on a podcast. He's giving a lot of interviews now. He kind of cut loose because he was helping the Dems win the election. He's got a book coming out, whatever. His memoir is coming out, so whatever. And he's on this podcast, and he's telling Democrats, all right, he's telling Democrats and people in his own party. He's not aiming this at the Republican Party, at the Green Party, at the Libertarian Party. He's aiming this at his own party, the people with a D in parentheses, either before or after their names on the TV screen. He tells them, go easy, ixnay on the defunde the police. You like my pig Latin there? Basically, he says, I understand what you're trying to do. I understand that you want to redirect some money in some big city police departments to better uses that you believe are better off in the long run for communities. Okay, so he gets out there and he says that on this podcast, apparently. And according to what the folks at NBC said, and I've also seen stories about this, he's getting pushback from the progressive part of his party. How stupid are these people? When you've got Democrats in the House right now, in the House of Representatives, who won their elections, right, telling members of their party that, you know, we could have lost our majority because you go out there and scream in your bullhorns, defund the police. You bang on your pots and pans, you scream in the bullhorns, defund the police. I have a friend of mine who works in a major network, and I don't need to tell you where, but this guy, I've known this guy for 15 years in the communications business. He works at a major network, and one of the things he does is he books people for interviews. He does interviews with them, and then these interviews are cut up, and the video is put together with a voice track of some other correspondent, so you see these on the news. I don't have to tell you which network. Well, he told me the other day, we were chatting online, he tells me the other day, he goes, you know, I just interviewed Congresswoman so-and-so. It was a woman Democrat from the middle part of the United States, and we were chatting about this online. And he said that she told him, now they obviously weren't recording this, but he says, hey, Congresswoman, I'm so-and-so from blah, blah, blah network, so let's get some background here. Let's get some basic questions with you, and then you'll be interviewed by whatever. It happens all the time. So he said to me that she told him something I think he said her quote to him was, this defund the police manure, not she didn't use that word, this defund the police almost cost me my, shall I say, effing seat. And you can fill in the blank. And she's telling my friend this on the record, who's a producer. So even Barack Obama on a podcast says, we understand what you're doing, but stop using the word defund the police. But he's being pulled over the coals now, and oh, he's not looking out for his own people. It's just the tone deafness of some people on the left, and yes, it's on the right too, but the tone deafness of some people on the left is just, sometimes it's magnificent. It reaches an Olympic level that makes me cry with happiness. It does. Here's a guy who was far from a conservative telling his own party, stop using the term defund the police. There's a gazillion ways other you could say this. Redirect funding. What would I suggest if I was doing PR work for them? You could say redirect. You could say recalibrate funding. You could say reassess funding. But when you say defund, you shoot yourself in the foot. But again, apparently, they don't get it. They just, so I heard that at the top of the show. I just felt I had to say that because it is just, it's for me, it's actually fun to watch. It's like a good, you know, good oil wrestling, like on Friday night at your local watering hole. T-shirt oil wrestling, whatever you want to call it.
Who you maybe remember, were our co-chairman of our vaccination advisory board. And we're going to spend a little bit of time, a lot of time, I hope, talking about the vaccination rollout plan. But first, let me set the table with our COVID daily summary. This is the good, the bad, and the ugly. What you see is a lot of tests. I guess that's good. A lot of these tests were part of the run-up, the Thanksgiving, in and around Thanksgiving, where you saw the crowds. A lot of cases, and the 7.13 positivity rate over 7%, that's the highest we've had so far. Let's cut to the chase. You know, back in the spring, you were testing a different cohort. This is broad-based testing, 7%. And I think a lot of that, it was not unexpected. It reflects the fact that, again, all the travel back and forth, maybe stirring it up, maybe the beginning of some of the Thanksgiving effects that we had anticipated. But it's a big number. Good news is hospitalizations are down. They have not been down for, I think, over a month. And it's a one-day number. Don't be a day trader, but it's worth looking at. Fatalities, another 20 fatalities. The governor's vaccine advisory group, you can see Reg up there in the corner, Deirdre, an incredibly diverse group of people who are healthcare professionals as well as representatives of the greater community, the religious communities, underserved communities, disabled communities, those that when the vaccine is ready to go, and it's almost ready to go, we can get out into the communities, explain to people why it's very important to them and their community and their families that they take the vaccine. We'll talk about that. So here's the timing on the vaccine's upcoming milestones. Timeline subject to change is an important asterisk there. We just got notice that Pfizer may suffer some delays in terms of supply chain right now. But let me tell you what we had anticipated and what we've been getting told. Today is December 3rd. In 1 week, we're going to have the FDA review of the Pfizer vaccine. It'll probably, they anticipate, take 48, 72 hours to complete that review. We anticipate the approvals. They're counting on those first shipments of the Pfizer vaccine around the country, including Connecticut, a week from Monday, December 14th. We anticipated about 31,000 doses. We'll see if that changes, given what we have been led to believe. Secondly, you've got also the Moderna vaccine. That's on a separate approval process. That's scheduled, a week from Thursday or 2 weeks from today for the FDA review, and they'll have their vaccines scheduled for delivery, as you can see here on the chart, on the 21st of December. Merry Christmas. That's a bigger shipment, 63,000, assuming we can stay on track here. And this is really important in terms of getting rolling out this vaccine right now. We'll be able to talk about that in just a minute. Who's the first to receive the vaccine? We followed the CDC guidance and they've rolled out a list of priorities that they recommend. I think you'll find from our vaccine group that we sort of followed their advice. We thought it was very sensible. Number one, phase 1A, 204,000 workers, healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, docs at the hospitals, as well as the clinics, the federally qualified health centers, front-facing people doing everything we can to keep us safe. That's priority number one. And to make sure that they're able to get that vaccine so they'll be able to keep at work. Secondly, and right alongside are nursing home residents and nurses, 22,000 nursing home residents. I think you can understand what the thinking is there. Number one, these are the folks most likely to suffer complications. These are the older folks who most likely suffer fatalities. And these are the folks most likely to go into the hospital. So not only are we hopefully saving lives, we're hopefully keeping these folks out of the hospital, which again adds to our capacity in the hospitals, why that's also in our first tier of vaccine receivers. And thirdly are the medical first responders. Those are EMT, those are fire and police to the degree to which they're driving ambulances, everything we can do to make sure they stay in the battle as well. Josh reminds me, these numbers are exact, but they assume only an 80% take-up at this point. So there'll be some variability. We're not mandating this, but I think you're going to see significant take-up with our strong recommendation. The vaccine distribution chart, which is here, little complicated, I guess, and it may be changing as we're hearing right now. But as of 12/14, we're looking to do the first 31,000 doses. And you can see they ramp up in the next week, 12/21, you've got 94,000 doses. That's because you're adding on Pfizer as well as Moderna. And you can see at the end of 125, we'll have distributed about 380,000 doses. That's over the next 6 weeks. Of those 380,000 doses, which are going to those first responders, that second column, it says second dose down there, if you got good eyesight, 212,000 will have received their second dose. So that means that by January 25th, we think the overwhelming majority of those first responders, nurses, docs, nursing homes, will have had their first and second dose, and another 150,000 will have had their first dose in terms of the next tier of people we're talking about. It is complicated. You know, Pfizer, you got to refrigerate it at a much lower temperature. Pfizer, it's every 3 weeks. Moderna, you refrigerate it at a different temperature. That's every 4 weeks. And that's why we have our extraordinary vaccine committee to make sure we're rolling this out in a way that gets it implemented properly. When we get the vaccines, we got to make sure that they can be delivered on a timely basis. So phase 1B. Phase one were those absolutely necessary healthcare first responders and the nursing homes I described. Phase 1B, which they start getting their first dose by the end of January, and it's really mid-January to late May. Critical workforce. These are folks on the front line. These are everything from daycare, food service workers, folks taking care of the most disadvantaged in the community, including some of the state employees. That includes teachers. That includes folks who are interfacing every day with the population on a critical basis. They can't telecommute. They can't go virtual. Also in that group are what they call other congregate settings. That can be group homes. That can be correctional facilities. Why is that? Because like nursing homes, they have much more likely a possibility of spread. No matter how serious our precautions, we're finding community spread often gets into these congregate settings. Thirdly, in phase 1B are adults over 65. Hey, that includes your governor for reasons you can imagine in terms of age and how the infections hit. And fourthly, and probably the biggest category, is high-risk people under the age of 65. And Reg and Deirdre can tell us how those are quantified. Phase 2, which will not start till later, late spring, early June, or June, depending on what the flow of the vaccines are. Those are younger people under 18, obviously the youngest least likely to shed the virus, and those remaining over 18. So I think you can see the prioritization, why we're doing what we're doing, and when you can expect your cohort to have access to the vaccine. It's not all good news, so I have a little fun here. I can't sleep. I'm too excited about the vaccine coming, they say, as we lead up to Christmas, just to give you a thought. CDC's been busy, And they also came up with new quarantine guidelines, which I think are worth paying attention to. They said, look, if you're not showing any symptoms and you get a negative PCR test, you only have to quarantine for 7 days. Or if there are no symptoms at all, quarantine for 10 days if you haven't taken the PCR test. 14 days is still recommended for high-risk situations. No offense, but just don't go visit your grandparents for 14 days. Probably nursing homes, stay quarantined, not that many places to go. So that gives you an idea of the continuum there. Thanks. I was on the 14th day of my quarantine when the CDC said 7 days with a PCR test is maybe enough, but I'll get over it. Look, more importantly, I'm so thankful to you, Reg, and you, Deirdre. Deirdre, as if you needed more things on your plate, the incredible work you have done in this changing circumstances, not just in terms of our infection rate, but what we're hearing from the pharma companies, what we're hearing from CDC. Our work is just beginning, and it starts right now. We have a chance to answer questions because there are going to be a lot of questions from people about the vaccine. Josh and Paul as well to answer.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
How will the vaccine get to the state? You know, what airport will it be arriving at? Then what are we talking about as far as ground transportation? And then once they get to the hospitals, how will it get to the general population, or at least the healthcare workers for now?
All right, vaccine board, you want to take that?
U.S. federal government is managing the logistics for delivering vaccine to the state of Connecticut, both for the general supply that's coming to hospitals and other vaccinators, and for the supply that's going to go to our nursing homes through CVS and Walgreens. So all of that logistics, they are taking care of through Operation Warp Speed in partnership with CDC. And then from there, so to answer the second part of your question, the state will designate at the governor's direction where we want the allocations to be shipped. So the governor showed the number of doses that we are anticipating and planning for, although they're subject to change. On a weekly basis, we will direct our federal partners where we want those to be shipped. And that will obviously evolve as the populations and the numbers evolve. And then from there, the vaccinators will either have the vaccine that they need shipped directly to them, or in some cases, there will be maybe a hub and spoke model where we'll transport some quantities of vaccine to vaccinators on a just-in-time kind of a basis.
Thank you.
News 8.
So according to this timeline, and it's subject to change, June is the kind of the end date when the last group of young 18 and under get it. Where does that leave us in the future? Does that mean this summer the masks come off? Do we still have to take precautions? People are really anxious to know when is this coming to end, and not that there's even an answer to that, because you have to look at a crystal ball, but can you give us an idea of what happens when everybody's vaccinated?
Deirdre, what happens?
So don't get rid of your masks yet for a couple of reasons. One is we don't anticipate a full vaccination, even according to this schedule, right? We're going to need to wait and see. We certainly hope that there'll be widespread adoption of the vaccine, but we're going to need to wait and see what percentage of the population takes the vaccine. We'll continue to learn about efficacy. And, we have an annual flu vaccine, and yet people still get flu on an annual basis. So the answer to your question, as you indicated, will evolve as we see the program rolling out. And we'll have more information about the potential to back off on some of our mitigation strategies over the summer, But I think we all need to just prepare ourselves for the continued need to protect ourselves and particularly high-risk individuals from COVID for through the majority of 2021.
And also, how is it being received by the medical community, the frontline workers? You have to order doses now for them. Have you any idea, taking surveys, 50%, 60% will take it or not? Do you have any numbers, even just for one hospital?
I'll be happy to take that. So, yes, we did survey, and I'm sure the other healthcare systems did as well, at Trinity Health in New England. Interestingly, our response rate was very high. It was north of 40%. And we surveyed all 13,000 employees. Most of them are nurses. Most of them were 55 and above. Over 60% said they would take the vaccine as soon as it's available. And that's without education, further explanation. We learn things every single day. So the goal here is to understand that all of our healthcare systems and all the those participating in phase 1A, you know, sort of where they stand. And it gives us just a little time to answer questions like we're doing today. Most of the questions that at least at Trinity Health in New England, were around efficacy, safety, and will we have to get the vaccine if we've had COVID? All those answers, as we learn more about it, will be provided. And again, the hope is that more will participate so that we can get to some degree of normalcy as soon as possible. Thank you.
NBC Connecticut.
How much are you expecting it to cost us to distribute the vaccine? Does the state even have enough money to do so?
Right now, the feds, as you know, are buying up the vaccine itself and handling the distribution to our locations. Deirdre, do you want to talk anything else about what there might be at the local level?
I'll start, and then I know Reggie has additional information to add. First of all, I want to make sure everybody knows that vaccines will be available to everyone, even those without health insurance, for no cost. So everyone should be reassured that they will have access to the vaccine when it becomes available and when their group is, when their time is up on the schedule for their particular population group. The other thing is that vaccinators who are healthcare providers will be able to bill insurance for the vaccine administration costs. So right now, if you go to the doctor and get a shot, the doctor is able to bill both for the vaccine itself and for the cost of administration. That reimbursement will also be available for this vaccine. So Reggie, you might have additional information about how, the systems are thinking about the cost.
Yeah, and outside of any additional cost, just having the ability to store adequately and in compliance, all the vaccines were the other charge that we had. And so if I remember correctly, there are at least 12 hospitals that are prepared to store the Pfizer vaccine, which was really, I think, the greatest challenge we have at this point, as the governor alluded to. But outside of that, there are no additional costs. I mean, training is being provided. The state is providing us training from that perspective. And we are doing what we need to do inside of each hospital to ensure that we can continue to do what we've been doing a good job at thus far since the pandemic started, and that is providing high quality and safe care.
Joining us right now for his monthly check-in, Chris Powell, editorial writer, the Journal Inquirer of Manchester. And Chris's piece that came out today dovetails nicely into maybe what the governor just announced. Chris, how are you, sir?
Oh, it was great to be with you again, Paul.
Thank you, Chris. Well, Chris, your piece that came out today, dated today, titled Epidemic Urgings Missed Target, in part, you talk about, and something I still emphasize every day that the governor speaks or we have unfortunate fatality numbers here, a huge percentage of the fatalities, sadly, from COVID-19 in the state are in the state's nursing homes. You point out a huge percentage. So it is good to hear just minutes ago the governor saying, something over 20,000 doses of the first round of these vaccines, Chris, finally will go to, the part of this pandemic, I think, that has been sorely underreported and just handled horribly.
Yeah, it's going to make sense to take care of the nursing home population first. But, you know, other than the vaccinations and, you know, daily testing, if we could arrange it, I'm not sure what we can do for the nursing home population. I mean, it's already cut off from people's families. If we're going to isolate them completely and make sure they have absolutely no risk of catching anything from anybody, I just worry that we're going to destroy their connection to their families, or we're going to destroy their will to live.
Mm-hmm. So it is fortunate, I guess the governor saying early, Chris, 22,000 doses starting as soon as the 14th of December will be good at least, and, you know, nursing home workers as well. So, you know, maybe, Chris, as you say, some of these deaths, which all officials say, a lot of professionals say, you know, can be exacerbated by loneliness. Maybe we can put the kibosh on this.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. I mean, I don't know how the figures will turn out for this week, but for the last 2 weeks, the governor has said that 70% or more of the state's virus-associated deaths have been in nursing homes, and I was kind of disappointed to the response he got, the policy response he got to those disclosures. Of course, the teacher unions demanded that we, you know, terminate all in-person schooling, and the mayor of New Haven, Justin Elker, said we should start closing businesses down again. Well, wait a minute. 70% of the deaths are in nursing homes. How does closing schools relate to that? How does closing businesses relate to that? There's something more important. As important as nursing home patients are, there is something more important than protecting nursing home patients, and that is to keep society functioning. There's more to society than nursing homes, and you can't destroy one side of society to protect the other side. You've got to try to keep everything going.
And you point out something interesting in this column for people who may not be able to read or have access to it. A couple of really renowned experts who are saying, Chris, that there may be actually a price to pay by these kids who are not in school. Talk about that, because I never saw that before until you cited it.
Yeah, there was an essay published last week in the New York Times, which is not terribly enthusiastic about President Trump. It was written by two professors at Columbia University who are also doctors. Dr. Donna Farber teaches immunology and surgery, and Dr. Thomas Connors teaches pediatrics. They wrote that closing schools and removing kids from their usual social environment is harmful to their health, because it prevents them from the normal association of their immune systems with microorganisms that they need to have contact with in order for their immune systems to develop and to give them the full immunity that they need as adults. And the two professors said that this was going to hamper kids. This closing of school and this shutting of kids up was going to damage kids into their adult lives, because it's going to stunt their immune systems. Now, it would be one thing if kids were dropping dead all over the place in school because of the virus, but they're not. There's very few infections of kids at all. There's very few infections as a result of their schooling. Now, certainly some kids may have chronic conditions that would argue for keeping them out of school at this time, but in terms of the population group at risk here, the kids are least vulnerable to the virus. And as these two doctors wrote in the Times last week, if you keep them out of any social environment, if you keep them from developing their immune systems, they are going to pay for it later on.
Chris, also, it's interesting to look at, and people love, there's a segment of society here, as you well know, that loves to compare us to Europe and how Europe handles things. Oh, look at the Europeans. They're so much better than we are. And it's interesting to note that, you know, several countries, Italy, Spain, France, they're not closing schools, and they have leaders there who, now it's a different governmental structure there, but they have leaders there saying, no, we will not, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, stop the education of our children. I have found that fascinating during this whole thing.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure how much better Europe is at the things that we are. Certainly, we seem to be having more fatalities than some European countries. But you know, people have to realize, you know, the United States is a federation. You know, we're basically 50 countries within one country, and we have 50 different jurisdictions, and there really is no authorization for the federal government to control 100% of life in the states. So, you know, one state is, you know, maybe going to go absolutely paranoid like New York or California, and another state like Nebraska, which is much more rural, you know, may not feel like it needs to be shut down as much. We are 50 separate you know, jurisdictions. This is the federal system, and there's going to be differences among the states. You know, we're not you know, quite as government heavy as Europe is.
Chris, finally, as we may be slowly with these vaccines starting to come in, trickling in, getting to a better flow toward the end of this month and into the new year, when hopefully, knock on wood, as I hit myself on the head here, maybe June or July, as the governor outlined today, when there may be more light at the end, the end of the tunnel here. I know we'll speak plenty of times before then, but what do you think we learn from this whole thing, primarily as Connecticut operates on a governmental level? Anything, do you think?
Well, I think we should have a larger you know, reserve supply of this personal protective equipment than we did when this began. I was reminded that of the polio epidemic we had back in the 50s and 60s. After that epidemic and the polio vaccines came out, we in Connecticut, I think, seem to think that epidemics were over. And Connecticut, along with other states, began to tightly restrict the expansion and opening of hospitals. You can't just open a hospital now. You've got to get what's called a certificate of need from the state. And most states operate this way. Well, guess what? You know, now we're terribly concerned that we're short of hospital space here. Well, you know, maybe we should have had some reserve hospitals ready to be opened and not have to rely on field hospitals like we opened at the Connecticut Convention Center in Hartford, only not to use it at all. You know, it looks to me like we need some more emergency resources in public health. But I'm afraid we don't have any money in Connecticut state government anymore for anything except you know, pensions for state employees.
I'll let you get that in as your last shot. Chris Powell's column. There's one coming up this weekend too, with the one released Thursday today, December 3rd. Interesting part of the column: epidemic urgings missed target. Chris, as always, take care. If we don't talk before the holiday, have a happy holiday season. We'll chat next month. Thank you.
Oh, thanks very much, Paul. You too.
Appreciate it. Chris Powell, the former managing editor, now an editorial writer, I think the best in the state, at the Journal Inquirer of Manchester. Or if you were in England, as they would say, Manchester.